Hello and welcome to Searching for the Question Live. My name is David Orban and I am very excited to have you on the show. We are streaming live across many different platforms and you can comment live, becoming part of the conversation. We are able to aggregate your comments wherever they are and I will be able to discuss them with my guest. My guest today is David Wood. David is a futurist, an author, a consultant in the field of technology and policy. We have been friends for many years. Recently, David published a new book, The Singularity Principles, and I took advantage of that to invite him to discuss the themes and topics that the book covers, as well as his specific subjective assessment of where the world is going in terms of radical technological change, how it is implemented, why we really need a new way of going about understanding the implications of that technology before we go and find out its consequences. David, welcome to Searching for the Question Live.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to an important discussion on truly important topics.
Why are these topics important in your view?
I'm particularly concerned that about the pace of change of technology, the acceleration in the increase in capabilities, and the fact that our social systems, our politics, and our philosophy is behind. It can't keep up. And as a result, there is greater tension, greater issues, more people feel themselves left behind, more people feel themselves alienated, and they are understandably upset. On the other hand, there are great opportunities within our grasp. If we are wise, we can grasp these opportunities and transition to a much better quality of life for everyone around the world who wants to be part of this with no one left behind.
During the 20th century, we have already seen a great deal of change in technologies and how people lived as a consequence. Someone who was born at the turn of the century, between the 1800s and the 1900s, didn't have electricity, didn't have cars with internal combustion engines, let alone airplanes or spaceships and the internet, all of which has become not only available, but widespread during the century. Well, maybe not spaceflight, but television, radio, telephone, so many examples. After that century, are you saying that the 21st century could see an equal or maybe even greater disruption due to technology?
I think that is possible. I think it's quite likely. It's true that remarkable things happened in the 20th century. For many parts of the world, life expectancy doubled. In many parts of the world, the number of people living under the poverty line shrank enormously. There's still too many people who don't have access to anything like enough material goods, food, and education, and so on. But if we look at the grand statistics, there have been amazing improvements. And it's not just improvements in computers. It's improvements in domestic equipment, such as the technology of the washing machine, which some people say had changed the lives of more people than computers. But still, I say what lies ahead could be even more fundamental. It's not just that we might see another doubling of life expectancy. We could see life expectancy going effectively infinite. It's not just that we're going to see more people accessing education. It's that we could all become more intelligent than Einstein, And potentially, we could all be more enlightened than the great enlightenment figures from consciousness research and so on. So these are very bold claims indeed. And I am aware that many people will say, this is hype, this is unrealistic. But I will look at the possibilities that can be enabled by the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution, nanotech, biotech, infotech, and cognotech, which are just in the early days of what they can deliver. And I will also point to what can be achieved once artificial intelligence reaches and surpasses human levels in all categories of thinking, when it reaches so-called AGI, artificial general intelligence, and fairly soon afterwards, self-improves likely to orders of magnitude more intelligent than today's humans in every aspect. That's going to turn everything upside down. And we need to be sure that it's turned upside down in a way that we will like and we will applaud and accept, rather than something that's going to make us all say we should have been more careful. Oops.
So you mentioned technologies that show great promise as well as dangers. Do you think that the lessons we learned from previous technological revolutions, the industrial revolution, the IT revolution, are sufficient, or we have to change our reference frame and we have to change our tools and methodologies as we look at the revolutions that the technologies that you mentioned, nano, bio, cogno, etc., imply?
We can learn a lot from the past. I believe that you can get better foresight from having better hindsight, an awareness of the complications, the tensions, the challenges, the contingencies of the past are useful in mapping out the contingencies and opportunities of the future scenarios. And sadly, we're not very good at drawing on lessons from the past. There are many things that we should have in our minds, but we don't. Simple example, we should have had in our minds in 2019 and 2020, the terrible flu pandemic of the 1819 to 1820. Sorry, let's get the dates right. 1918 to 1920. But most people didn't know much about it. When I grew up, we had lots of films on TV about the First World War. Shocking, but there were more people killed in that flu than in the First World War. And that was sort of suppressed from our minds for all kinds of reasons. Well, there are other lessons from history which we're not very good at bringing into mind for reasons we might come back to. But even so, I think there are more important lessons ahead, things that aren't just repeats of the past. In the past, there were disasters, but on the whole, we could recover from the disasters. There were terrible things that happened, but those who survived managed to, on the whole, be wiser. But the kind of disasters we could have today might wipe out the whole planet, might prevent us from any chance at recovering, which is why we need to become better at foresight and anticipation and monitoring, because with some of these issues, there won't be a second chance.
So, there could be an entire series of these conversations looking at each of the technologies that you mentioned because they have different characteristics. Our ability to, for example, engineer pathogens is improving greatly. And if among humans, as it seems to be, there are those driven by fanatical desire to kill are able to get their hands to the technologies that allow them to engineer these pathogens, then yeah, we definitely have a problem. We could look at what are the dangers of nanotechnology and so on. Instead of doing that, because, well, we could decide to do a series of these conversations, but today I would like us to concentrate on artificial intelligence, especially artificial general intelligence and self-improving super intelligence. So why is it fundamentally different than technologies that came before? Why is it, as you stated, that if we don't get it right, it could have negative impacts on an existential scale from which we wouldn't recover? And by the way, I am showing the page of your book published very recently, The Singularity Principles, which gets into detail on a lot of the things that we will be talking about today. So why is advanced AI and AGI fundamentally different, and why do they represent an existential risk?
AI enables all other technologies to be developed faster. Previously, technologies were developed by human ingenuity. Well, now there's artificial ingenuity that can be coupled with human ingenuity, and it can come up with all kinds of new designs. People used AI to devise new drugs or to explore new uses for old drugs. And that's incredibly useful. Brief aside here, we have an issue in the world with antibiotic resistance. Things like penicillin have saved hundreds of millions, maybe billions of lives by fighting against bacterial infections. But bacteria are evolving to be resistant. How can we find new antibiotic drugs? People have been looking, but there hasn't been many breakthroughs recently until the team at MIT a couple of years ago used deep learning to teach the system, first of all, what were the characteristics of existing successful antibiotic drugs and what were the characteristics of all other drugs that didn't have an antibiotic effect. And then, once it had been trained, it was fed in the details of 6,000 drugs that had been explored for other reasons, cancer drugs, anti-diabetic drugs, mainly drugs that had been failed long before they ever came to market. And the system highlighted a few that said, you know, these drugs could have similar characteristics to the antibiotic drugs that you already have. And by the way, the programmers picked out the ones that were quite different, superficially at least, from existing antibiotic drugs. So they could be using mechanisms in a different way. And one of them came through trials so far, trials in vitro, in test tubes, trials in vivo, in animals, and is well on the way to becoming an encouraging antibiotic. So that's called Halicin, that particular drug, with the HAL being a nod to the computer HAL from the 2001 film. But guess what? People can use that same technology not to devise new antibiotic drugs, but to devise terrible new types of poison. And the researchers wondered about this, and some of them briefly experimented with it and then said, oh, we don't want to continue this experimentation anymore because we don't want more terrible poisons to be available. But guess what? There are some people who do want these more terrible poisons. And they may have tried and failed in the past to create some, but if they have AI to rely upon, then maybe they can come up with worse poisons. This is not an abstract hypothetical possibility. There have been cults, for example, Om Shinrikyo in Japan, an eclectic mixture of some Buddhist ideas and Christian apocalypticism and some Shinto elements from traditional Japanese religions. They gained notoriety by releasing sarin gas in the Tokyo underground, killing a number of people, nothing like as many as the cult had hoped. They were also researching anthrax and other possible weapons, and they didn't have the capability to carry out these other potentially more terrible drugs, terrible attacks. But as Eliezer Yudkowsky, the rationality advocate, said a few years ago, he refers to something called Moore's Law of Mad Scientists. The original Moore's Law talks about every 18 months, computer technology is roughly twice as powerful for the same cost input. Well, Moore's Law of Mad Scientists says every 18 months that passed, the IQ necessary for a mad person to destroy the world comes down by one or two IQ points. Now, there's no quantitative analysis behind it, but we can see heuristically it's likely to be true that somebody who is disturbed and upset, possibly a follower of one of these apocalyptic religious or pseudo-religious cults, possibly somebody from an estranged political group, possibly somebody who's just fed up and angry with the world, and sadly there are lots of these people, they could use AI, possibly in combination with drones, possibly in combination with 3D printing, to create terrible weapons which would be more deadly, a lot more deadly, than COVID, which brought much of the world into a state of understandable panic in the last few years.
The examples that you gave and the description of AI working in combination with evil humans are frightening enough. They are, however, examples of vertical, specialized, narrow AI. Artificial general intelligence, if possible, is going to be qualitatively different, exactly because rather than applicable to just one set of problems, it will be, or it will represent, a general problem solver with potentially, possibly, an autonomous and independent agency, independent goal sets, an independent trajectory on where and how to apply this problem-solving ability. Are there people who are, according to your knowledge of the industry, working on AI who shrug off the possibility of AGI ever happening? Are there still people like famously Lord Kelvin, literally days or weeks before the first powered flight by the Wright brothers, who said that would never be possible? Are there similarly people in the field of AI, experts, who are peacefully sleeping because they believe AGI is never going to be possible?
There are people who say there are risks of AGI in the future, but we shouldn't worry about them at all just now because they're very far into the future. A famous example is Andrew Ng, who is a brilliant educator at Stanford. He has worked in Google and in Baidu, so he has insights into what's happening in some of the most advanced Western AI companies and some of the most advanced Chinese AI companies. But his famous saying is he is no more worried about an AI apocalypse than he is about overpopulation on Mars. You know, we might have a few people on Mars, it's going to take a long time before Mars is overpopulated. Well, I disagree. I think, first of all, we already have in today's AI many near existential risks. And as we'll maybe talk about shortly, tomorrow's AI may still not be the full AGI, but it is increasingly general. So there are steps towards full generality. And it wasn't obvious before, but what's happened in the last few years is we have systems that can be quickly repurposed from one task into another. So there are increasing existential risks from the AIs that we are just on the point of developing, even if we don't get all the way to AGI. Andrew Ng's by no means alone here, and it could be worthwhile exploring the reasons why people like him and others reject talk of a singularity anytime soon.
An example, this repurposing is done by DeepMind, a division of Google, or a company owned by Google, that developed artificial neural networks that became very successful in various tasks, such as, for example, in 2016, beating the then world champion of the game of Go. And then took the same kind of neural network and tasked it with other objectives, such as in this case, the prediction of the shape of proteins, the protein folding problem. and progressively released enormous, ever-increasing sized databases with these protein shapes. As of today, just this past July, they released over 200 million structures. And this is an example of this kind of repurposing that you mentioned. Like the approach, of course, but as you said, it is also a danger. It also, I think, represents a useful example where the system and the humans that are involved in the system can be seen as a unit. If the neural network itself is unable to repurpose itself and pick its next target, well, the human managers and the human researchers at DeepMind will do that. And so if we look at DeepMind as an organization, as a unit, then DeepMind is already approaching that kind of AGI threshold, except that it is a hybrid. It's not without human components. So let's assume that Andrew Ng is wrong and that AGI is possible. At that point, it doesn't matter too much when, because we don't know how long we need in order to protect ourselves from the downsides of potential unfriendly AGI. This is why you feel there is this sense of urgency that is independent from the timeline, because it could be dependent from the size of the problem. What should we then be doing? What can we do apart from, and that is already a great progress, becoming aware of the issue, what can we do?
Well, it's worth spending more time emphasizing the urgency, pointing to realistic scenarios, not just the hypothetical paperclip maximizers, which make many people just roll their eyes and say, nobody's going to create something that stupid. Let's not bother with these adolescent fantasies. There are many more realistic scenarios of not perfectly intelligent AGI, but imperfectly intelligent AI that is more general than today, but not at that superhuman level, how it could be given more control of our weapon systems, or of our social media networks, of our infrastructure, of the possible cyber hacking, and could do terrible things in the relatively near future, especially if we might be inclined to deploy AI in geoengineering endeavors. If people are increasingly upset, as I understand they should be, about the accelerating climate change, and they're worried, and they might say, let's choose plan B, or maybe it's plan C, I'm not sure. Geoengineering, it's complicated. Let's get an AI involved in that. And if it's very clever, it might convince people to give it some autonomy in its own decisions. But then, after having got 99 decisions right in a row, and we are completely trusting it, it's like the sat-nav that gives us the right directions 99 times in a row, and then leads us up literally the garden path instead of into the proper direction. Well, imagine then. So we should be emphasizing the urgency.
One of our viewers asks to comment on a similar example. He talks about controlled environment agriculture, which is an advanced and intensive form of hydroponics, exponential farming. And the reason he does that is because he has a company specialized in that field. And so your comment probably, or your answer to Thomas, would be absolutely AI can help, but we have to be cautious about delegating to AI systems crucial, vital functions of human civilization, because the downsides of it getting it wrong at any time in the future could be huge. In your case, the geoengineering system that goes off the rails, or in the case of the example of Thomas, some advanced food production system that stops producing food.
Possibly because we have inadvertently adopted a monoculture. Sometimes we emphasize one type of a crop because we think it's got many unique properties, but then there could be some particularly nasty blight in the way that some of our favorite crops are vulnerable to particular pathogens. And you might say, well, we'll be smart enough to cure that, but maybe it's of a type that is sort of too late to fix. So yes, indeed. One of the principles I advocate is maintain human oversight. So yes, we should deploy as much simulation technology as possible to analyze and to indeed make progress, but we have to maintain human oversight at all times. And I also highlight promote auditability. Auditability means that there are ways always to check what's going on inside. Human in the loop, yes, indeed. And it's not always possible for decisions that need to be taken rapidly, which is why in such a case, you need to have analysis beforehand that we're very sure, as far as we can be, that any decisions taken in the heat of a moment are likely, as far as we can foresee, to be the right ones, rather than something that will lead us into a new dark age.
So am I correct if I say that a lot of the recommendations and a lot of the principles in the book, the singularity principles, are methodological, even epistemological. It is a new, more self-aware kind of exploration of scientific and technological possibilities that we need to apply because the less cautious and blinder approach is not sustainable anymore. The downsides of that approach are too large, potentially.
Exactly so.
An amazing example of this is when the physicists at the Manhattan Project designing the atomic bomb sat down and asked themselves, isn't this detonation going to ignite in a self-catalytic effect all the atmosphere, consuming free oxygen and suffocating every life form depending on free oxygen in the planet? They calculated and they decided, nah, it is not going to. And then they went ahead and exploded the atomic bomb. Is AGI going to require that kind of crossing the fingers approach? And is that enough? Can we exhaust the ways that things could be going wrong with AGI?
Well, that is a good example. And in that case, it wasn't just crossing fingers. The concern was real. And by the way, a similar concern was raised in the German nuclear weapons race for a while under Heisenberg. There was a group of German scientists doing the equivalent of the Manhattan Project. And it looks as if Heisenberg quite wisely raised the idea that maybe they would destroy the world. And Adolf Hitler got to hear about it. And he asked, may this happen? And Heisenberg, or an intermediary, said, well, we can't rule it out. And that led Hitler to deprioritize that project and put all his efforts instead on the V1 and V2 rockets. So that concern was understood. And it's also interesting that the leaders of the Manhattan Project had multiple different people analyzing the risks of the atmosphere igniting and using different analysis. So that's what we can learn from. But if we roll forward, If we roll forward, yes, that's a fascinating story on Oppenheimer. Would you like to comment on that, David?
Two comments. One is that the Oppenheimer Alternative is a science fiction book that explores a hypothetical spy mission to possibly kill Heisenberg if it turns out that he's ready to give the go-ahead on the research for developing a German atomic bomb. And I'm not going to spoil the rest of the book. It's wonderful and greatly recommended. The other is that there will be a movie coming out this fall, if I am not mistaken, about Oppenheimer that is... at least I believe, bound to be very, very good by the director, Christopher Nolan. Mm. So as we imagine the applicability of the existential anguish that Oppenheimer and others involved in the design and the development of the atomic bomb find themselves in, to our situation today, the book and the movie and other materials like these could be really helpful. So back to the question, is AGI a atomic bomb?
I didn't catch that. It's slightly froze. Is AGI like the atomic bomb?
Yes. Can we... approach the development of AGI with those methods that were used and those fail-safes that were used for the development of the atomic bomb, including that there are international bodies like the International Atomic Energy and the International Atomic Energy Commission that are responsible for overseeing initiatives around the use of this extremely dangerous technology.
Yes, there are lessons to be drawn there, definitely. First of all, if I wind forward from 1945, when the first atomic bombs were detonated, to 1954, when the first fusion-based hydrogen bombs were detonated, and there was a surprise, a big surprise, that first detonation. The scientists had calculated the likely explosive yield. They weren't quite sure. They gave a range, and they therefore evacuated a certain region around an island where this bomb was going to go off. And when it did go off, it was 2.5 times as large as the maximum they had expected. Oops. So many of the measuring equipment was destroyed in the blast rather than recording things from a safe distance. There was a Japanese fishing boat that was well outside the original exclusion zone, but it got caught up in radioactive fallout, and one of the occupants died from complications arising from his experiences. So there's the first person who died as a result of a hydrogen bomb. So why did all these brilliant scientists get it wrong? Yes, indeed, Castle Bravo. Well, they had failed to foresee one particular aspect of the reaction. There's two kinds of lithium. Lithium's, I think, element number 3 in the periodic table. It comes in different isotopes, and it was used in packing the explosive parts. And it turned out that in certain circumstances, one of these isotopes of lithium would also get involved in the nuclear reaction in a way that had not been foreseen. So we are lucky that it was only 2.5 times as powerful as had been expected. Now, wind forward further. There have been occasions when the world almost came to blows from managing or mismanaging nuclear weapons. There was a famous case in, I think, 1983, when a primitive AI of the time, not very clever at all by today's standards, thought it had detected a number of missiles coming over the North Pole from the US towards Russia. And according to the letter of the processes, the team that responded to this alert should have rung up the higher command, and it would have gone all the way to Yuri Andropov. And he probably would have pressed the button. Why? Because as a young man, Yuri Andropov had watched the leader of the Soviet Union at the time, Joseph Stalin, ignore for a long time warnings that Hitler was actually invading the Soviet Union. Joseph Stalin was committed to his own ideology that he was smarter than Hitler, and he couldn't bear the idea that he had been outsmarted. So Andropov was determined not to be outsmarted by his possible enemies again. But thankfully, the person you're showing on there, that remarkable Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov,
who was not old at the time, he was like in his 25th year.
That's right. He was a lieutenant colonel, so he had some seniority, and thankfully he was a civilian despite his military credentials. So he was slightly, he came from a different background, so he was slightly more independently minded. His colleagues wanted to follow the process. He said, you know what, I don't really trust this IT system very much, and so I think it's surely wrong. And he had his own intuitions. Now that's one case. The Future of Life Institute on its website has a list of about 20 possible near misses with nuclear weapons. So even with all the care that we have put into managing nuclear weapons, we have come at various times quite close to an accidental exchange of nuclear weapons. And if we have AI systems, more sophisticated AI systems in control, then we hope that they're not going to make mistakes, but who knows how they might be confused in the heat of the moment. After all, what confuses AI systems sometimes is another AI system also operating in the environment it did not expect. So if we look at some of the strange stock price movements, some very bizarre stock price movements known as flash crashes, they've got several different things that cause them. But one, it seems, is the unexpected interactions of two algorithms that each was doing something that was very sensible from its own point of view. But when you combine them together, oops, there was this adverse reaction. So we can learn from these previous cases that there are real dangers here, existential dangers, which is why, thankfully, there is now an increasing amount of research into what should be done. But I want at this point to slightly pivot and say that I consider a lot of the research that's being done to be likely not to be successful because it puts too much emphasis on possibly finding one clever solution. It's a bit like some people say, nobody who really understands it says this, but I often get lay people saying this to me. All we need to do is program in to the silicon Asimov's three laws of robotics, say. Or other people are hoping that by some clever mathematics, and I'm in favor of clever mathematics. I spent 4 years of my life studying mathematics at Cambridge University, so I love clever mathematics. But there is the hope that by clever mathematics, we can somehow constrain all AI. And there are other people who are also pursuing, to my mind, overly narrow a view into how we might have a comprehensive solution. I don't think there can be a comprehensive solution unless we are using comprehensive methods, which is why I don't advocate three laws of robotics or one law or three principles. It turns out I have got 21 principles, which wasn't a number I devised to start off with. I started with a smaller number, but over the years, as I talk more with people, I realized actually we don't just need to constrain the technology. We need to constrain how the development teams work. We also need to constrain the interactions of politics with the technology. And most important of all, if I go back to the beginning of my set of principles, we need to be better at encouraging people to think through consequences in advance from multiple points of view. This is my principle of take the whole system viewpoint, involve peer reviews, and insist that we review possible externalities, which is the side effects that are not taken into the measurements of a rather naive and financial systems, say.
If your approach is correct, and we don't need 22 or 25 of those principles, and the lack of inclusion of the missing principles is not fatal to the approach, and assuming that the 21 principles are embraced and implemented globally, we are fine. Let's assume. On the other hand, you just published your book, so we are not there yet. What is your assessment in terms of the complex issue of knowledge transfer debate and application of the regulations that would be needed, a global consensus around them, and the urgency of the matter. How likely do you see that we will get this right rather than the gazillion ways that it can go wrong?
I'm not complacent at all. I see lots of evidence that we are messing things up big time. And it depresses me quite often, to be frank, which is why I think we have to dig deep and we have to encourage each other and we have to be smarter at finding the best solutions and sharing the best ways of communicating. If I look at the caliber of the public discussion of things like the response to COVID, some of it was very inspiring. We managed to develop new vaccine solutions faster than most people had anticipated. After all, before COVID, there hadn't been a single successful deployment of any vaccine large scale against any coronavirus. So we got some of it right, but there's been so much crazy talk, talk that appears to be scientific, but is, as a philosopher of science might say, pseudoscientific, or as we might say more generally, is fake science. We have not been good at having that conversation. And it's the same with so many other things. If I look at the caliber of the political discussion in my own country just now, where there are, at time of recording, two candidates debating each other to be the next prime minister, two candidates from the Conservative Party, the caliber of that conversation is deeply depressing because they are focusing on a narrow set of objectives, how to lower taxes, how to remove regulations, rather than on a much wider range of key issues. So there are many reasons to be depressed, but at the same time, there are reasons to take heart. And we have to have the stability of thinking to cope with these two conflicting sets of impressions at the same time. So on the positive side, there is much more discussion in an extending community. It's a rationalist community, or the less wrong community, or the singularitarian community, the transhumanist community, and a significant number of people who are working in AI, but probably only a minority. There is a growing attention to the fact that first, AI seems to be getting better in many ways, faster than had been previously anticipated. Therefore, we need to accelerate the study of AI safety. So there are some encouraging things, and there are even some politicians, often ex-politicians, as it turns out, because when you're in politics, you've got to appeal to the lowest common denominator, sadly, to be elected. But once you're free from the pressures of re-election, sometimes ex-politicians can state things more wisely. And if I look at the UK, I complained a minute or two ago about the state of politics in the UK. Well, there are some positive signs too. We have something called the All-Party Parliamentary Group, APPG, on AI, which mainly has representatives from the House of Lords, dare I say it, which is the ex-politicians rather than the current politicians, but some MPs are there, and they are starting to discuss these issues. Nothing like as fast as I would like, but there are some signs in the right direction. And other countries are more advanced, I think. So if I look at what's happening in Dubai, or in Singapore, or in parts of Canada, there are steps forwards.
I am showing China here, for example, where they have recently introduced self-driving cars without a human operator. So contrary to what is happening in many places where the cars are able to drive themselves, but there is always a human in control, these cars are now operating with passengers only. And they still have wheels, even though future designs, once we become familiar with their behavior and their performance, will stop including the wheels. What is interesting is that Baidu, the operator of these cars, actually asked the local Chinese regulators the ability to expand to 10 more cities from Wuhan and Chongqing, where they are currently operating. So it looks that it is going very well. This is, I think, a fantastic, positive example of the application of advanced artificial intelligence, still narrow intelligence, but a narrow intelligence of a kind that starts to integrate a lot of diverse types of input in order to generate an outcome that is complex and highly dependent on the avoidance of catastrophic results. So I think that the rollout and the management of self-driving cars could be an interesting way of looking at how the problem is going to be addressed in various parts of the world.
Well, I had an experience with an advanced AI part of a car recently. I was visiting my mother in the north of Scotland, and I hired a car that was a different make from the one I usually use. And I realized, oh, it's dipping the headlight automatically. So when you're in these country roads in the north of Scotland without streetlights, at nighttime, you typically show the full beam, except when there's another car coming from the opposite direction, you have to dip. And that's what I've been doing all the years of my life that I've been driving. And I found, oh, it's doing it automatically. Except one time it didn't. I was coming closer to a car and I realized, oh, the car's still got its full beam on. Why? And I was trying to figure out how to turn it off. And the car coming the other way had flashed its lights brightly at me in anger, as it were. Now we passed each other without any accident. But that's an example. You know, we are excited by the capabilities. It is wonderful. You don't have to think anymore about turning the full headlight on and off. But when it goes wrong, maybe it's too late and we humans aren't able to fix things. So in the case of an individual self-driving car, what could go wrong? Well, sadly, some people are killed in occasional accidents. It could be worse than that, of course. Imagine if all the self-driving cars are talking to each other, which makes sense because they want to avoid getting into awkward standoffs. You go first. No, you first. No, you first. And then they can coordinate at high speed. But imagine if somebody were to hack into that whole system. Imagine if that person was inclined on a malicious outcomes, they could then cause all these self-driving cars to misbehave at the same time. And you could have many more people killed in a single hour of accidents than have been killed in a whole year previously of human driving. So that's a reason to raise the caliber of making sure that the software is secure against any such hacking. And sadly, the track record of many companies is that often there are security holes. There have been plenty of examples where the security has been hacked, sadly.
The AI systems today are advancing rapidly, but we cannot still understand the full set of risks of AGI systems.
So you're not asking me to respond, you're asking an intelligent system to respond.
That's right. This is OpenAI's GPT-3, which is a neural network with billions, actually hundreds of billions of parameters, that is able to generate text starting from a given prompt. So let's read the answer or the completion of the sentence or the paragraph that I wrote. Some risks of AGI systems include: the systems may become smarter than humans and take over the world. The systems may become uncontrollable and pose a threat to humanity. May be used for malicious purposes, such as creating false information or weaponizing AI. May fail and cause widespread damage and disruption. We need to research and understand the risks of AGI systems before they are developed further, says the artificial intelligence.
Well, I'd give that 9 out of 10. That's a right? remarkable set now, of advice.
Now, isn't it? I mean, I like it a lot too. And there is a GPT-2 detector, because GPT-2, which is a predecessor of GPT-3, and even though you and I are fine with that kind of output, this system is not. This system is saying, this text has been written by AI. And the reason why this fake label actually matters is because Google is analyzing websites that include text written by AI, assuming, regardless of the quality and regardless of the value of the text, that it is spam a priori. And I find it interesting exactly because you and I feel that this list has value. So Google wants to be an AI company, an AI first company, as long as others don't use AI, and will penalize them if they do.
Well, this is a sign that things are changing so fast that we haven't been able to make up our minds. We have conflicting intuitions about these things, and we can sympathize with what Google's trying to do. We want to identify sites that are probably spam or malicious or just lazy and highlight them. And on the other hand, we know that many writers in the future will take advantage of this. They will have a few ideas themselves. They'll use this as the starting point. And then if I were writing it, I would re-edit one or two of the sentences and change it. But it would still have text originating from GPT-3.
We said during this conversation that, things are truly unique in this moment of time in the history of human civilization. There have been times that some radical revolution happened, and typically there were some big losers. Some of the earliest revolutions were, for example, when aerobic life took over, and anaerobic bacteria couldn't survive much except where they are today, on the sides of deep sea or deep oceanic vents, where they get the kind of nutrition they need. But everywhere else on Earth, those life forms that use oxygen instead are dominating. Another example could be in an era that we know too little about. I am not a specialist, and I don't want to pretend that I know why we don't know about it enough, but some of my intuition is that we don't want to find the answer. And it is the era when, after the planet sharing its ecosystems amongst several humanoid species that coexisted, we are now in an era where just one humanoid species is dominating and all the others are extinct. That humanoid species, of course, is us. And all the ones that lost are dead. We cannot ask them why, but I believe we killed them. So we don't want to end up to be on the losing side. We have examples of radical changes where the losing side has just no chance of participating in the future. What do you believe is going to happen?
What happens is, to a large extent, up to us, whether we foresee things clearly enough, whether we are able to focus on the right priorities, whether we're able to coordinate and build a coalition of the willing to make a difference. But if we stand back, if we get distracted, if we focus instead on shorter-term issues, we are likely to be overwhelmed by the pace of technological change. And then we might suffer the same fate as these other humanoid species which were left behind. Or we might suffer the fate of gorillas, and that the few of us will still exist, but we don't determine the future of our own species. These previous transitions were largely unmanaged. Nobody thought out what's going to happen. This is what we can do differently. We can ensure that we think through the possibilities, and I think we should highlight as an important priority diversity, support for diversity, encouragement for diversity. We should not be encouraging all humans to become replicas of each other. If people want to have different morphological expressions, then they should be allowed to have morphological freedom. If they want to get together in different social groups, we should encourage that as well. And so my vision for the future is that people will all have the opportunity to be upgraded in various ways by taking advantage of technology. But if people wish, for whatever reasons, not to be upgraded, if their vision of the future is a bit like 21st century Amish, selective, careful adoption of some technology but not the rest, then we should enable that and encourage it, because humanity as a whole will be richer out of that diversity. But it's not going to come just from wishful thinking. It's not going to come by hoping there's a simple solution like, hey, we can just switch off the AIs if they misbehave. After all, the AI is likely to be highly distributed, so good luck with finding an off switch for the entire internet and even the dark internet. So we're going to need to call upon the very best of human values, the very best of human principles, pool together, again, a diverse set of understandings. I'm by no means set that there are exactly 21 principles that we need. I'm quite expecting that others will come along and restate some of my principles, express them better, and point out gaps. And I'm more than happy to see this list evolve. But we can't do nothing. We can't just get distracted. If we are distracted, we are likely to end up in a new dark age or worse.
There will be another interesting development shortly, because on September 30, Tesla is supposed to announce the prototype of their humanoid robot Optimus. What they are doing in this AI Day 2 is showing the hardware and software and process-oriented improvements that they are making to the self-driving cars, the Tesla cars. But last year, they announced that they fully embrace the fact that these cars are computers on wheels. And if they are able to build a computer on wheels that can interpret the world and take actions that are generalized in the world, then substituting the wheels with legs and hands, they have a robot that potentially can move around in a human environment, being able, as Elon Musk says, to take over jobs that are boring, repetitive, or dangerous. But of course, they will not stop there. And the entire equation on which our economy has been built, the limited nature of human labor, is going to be completely upended. Because these robots are going to be very expensive at the beginning, but then their price will go down, and more businesses will see it fit to equip themselves with these robots and amortize their cost over the course of several years, with very, very open questions about human dignity, human purpose, and the ability of society at large to support a future where merely biological humans find a reason to be productive members.
It's going to shake things up. When I say it, I may refer to some company producing excellent humanoid robots. There's a good chance it could be Elon Musk's work. He has a fascinating re track record, mixed track record. Often his schedule slips, but then he delivers after the schedule has slipped, and sometimes what he delivers is more than what people were expecting. Now, he's not the only game in town here. We can point to the Sophia and Grace robots of Singularity Net. We can point to the work done by Amazon, who I think recently bought another robot company. Is it Roomba, the vacuum cleaner company?
Correct.
And there are many other robotic companies around. What Boston Dynamics is doing, who owns them now? I think it's Hyundai. So sooner or later, there will be a breakthrough. And I think it's going to be a bit like what happened with smartphones. Many of us in the early days of the smartphone industry predicted time and again there would be breakthroughs with smartphones, and it was delayed a long time. We saw incremental progress, but not enough. And even the first iPhone from Apple was disappointing in many ways because it wasn't 3G. You couldn't forward an SMS message you'd received. There wasn't a front-facing camera, and it was a bit of a mixed bag. It had wonderful features and it had a lot of disappointment. But before long, Apple had improved the iPhone to the extent that it could no longer be ignored. And it turned the mobile phone world upside down. So it may well be that Elon Musk's company, or maybe another company, maybe one we haven't even mentioned, and there are lots in Korea that's doing fascinating work on robots. Maybe one of them will be the ones that will break through. And when this happens, it's going to cause a lot of reflection. And we had better be ready in advance with good answers. So rather than just waiting for a sudden crisis of confidence, we should be preparing for different scenarios, which is what I do with Delta Wisdom. You know, Delta Wisdom is about thinking things through, the how companies might respond to scenarios that won't necessarily happen, but it is useful to think things through in advance. You develop a foresight muscle, which allows you to be less dominated by future shock when surprising things happen.
As well as your blog on the other URL that I am showing, and people can also follow your Twitter account to be up to date with what you do, and of course subscribe to your YouTube channel. So, David, as I said at the beginning, there are certainly a lot of consequences of the various topics that you touch upon in your book, and we could dedicate many episodes to additional conversations that go deeper and deeper and more detail in each of them. And I hope we will have a chance to do so. I know that you are about to leave for extensive travel for several weeks. So I'm grateful that you could dedicate this time to be here with us and have this conversation. Congratulations for the publication of your book, The Singularity Principles. There you go. And thank you very much for being here with us today.
It's a real pleasure. You ask great questions, and we haven't by any means got to the end of the conversation, but I think we have placed some important points on the table. So we are discovering the key questions, which is what this show is all about.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone, for viewing and participating with your questions in searching for the question live. I am looking forward to have other guests in the future. In the meantime, you are welcome to join our Discord server to keep the conversation going. There is also, for those of you who are watching this from Italy, an Italian YouTube channel with Italian guests, a separate one. And if you like what I do, you are welcome to become a supporter on patreon.com/DavidOrban. Thank you very much and see you next time.